Welcome to the debate. So, imagine you are the captain of a massive leaking ship.
Okay.
Your crew is exhausted, the water is rising in the lower decks, and you have exactly enough lumber to make a choice. Do you patch the hull today to keep out the water for, you know, another few hours, or do you use that lumber to build a specialized automated pump that will clear the water for the rest of the voyage?
Will you patch the hull? Absolutely. Because, I mean, if the ship sinks today, that specialized pump you're building for tomorrow is just sitting at the bottom of the ocean.
Right.
You have a duty to keep the ship afloat right now for the crew that is currently standing in the water.
But if you only ever patch the hull, you never solve the underlying structural problem. You just consume all your lumber, patching hole after hole until the ship inevitably sinks anyway. And today, we are exploring this exact profound tension at the heart of our healthcare system.
It's a massive issue.
It really is. We're looking at how society should balance the urgent need to incentivize pharmaceutical innovation against the strict fiduciary responsibility to limit public healthcare spending.
Yeah, it really is the ultimate tightrope walk. We're constantly caught between paying for the healthcare system of today and funding the medical breakthroughs of tomorrow.
Exactly. And our discourse today is grounded entirely in the 2025 book Building Better Pharma Policy in Canada by Brett J. Skinner. It's this really comprehensive examination of the economic and health outcomes of government decisions regarding patented medicines.
And, you know, just to lay our cards on the table from the outset, my position is that strict price regulations and budget limits are necessary fiduciary tools. They exist to protect taxpayers and ensure the long-term sustainability of public health systems.
While I argue that prioritizing pharmaceutical innovation and market pricing is actually an essential investment in human capital that ultimately lowers overall healthcare costs.
So those are the lines in the sand.
They are. And to really understand this, we have to start with a fundamental perspective shift that the source material demands. We have to stop viewing spending on innovative medicines as just like a mere budget line item.
Right, a sunk cost.
Exactly. We can't look at it as a sunk cost that we just have to swallow. Instead, we need to understand it as an economic investment in human capital.
What exactly do you mean by human capital in this specific context?
I mean that when we cure a disease or, say, shift a patient from a highly expensive inpatient hospital bed to just taking an outpatient pill, we are doing way more than just treating a symptom. We are keeping the workforce productive.
Mm-hmm.
We are reducing the massive societal costs of untreated illness, like lost wages, disability payments, and, you know, the burden on family caregivers. But getting to that innovative pill, that automated pump for our ship, is a brutal, unforgiving process.
Well, it is undeniably risky. I'll give you that.
Risky is an understatement. Let's just look at the mechanics of how a drug actually gets to market. The material highlights that pharmaceutical research and development can cost up to $4.5 billion for a single successful new drug.
Which is a staggering number.
It sounds absurd until you realize why it's so high. It's because that figure factors in a 90% failure rate in clinical trials. 9 out of 10 drug candidates fail.
Wow.
Yeah. So the one successful drug has to pay for the research and development of the 9 that didn't make it.
Which obviously requires massive capital up front.
Exactly. And here is the crucial data point. The industry, not the government, funds the vast majority of this. In Canada, 91% of pharmaceutical R&D is funded by private companies.
Right.
If we do not provide strong intellectual property protections and allow for market-based pricing, the incentives to take on that $4.5 billion risk just evaporate. No rational entity is going to throw billions of dollars at a 90% failure rate if the government is just going to cap the price of the one success at a fraction of its value. The automated pump simply never gets built.
I don't disagree that the R&D process is incredibly capital intensive. And yes, the failure rate drives up the cost. But public health systems operate under inescapable economic realities.
Sure, but...
Resources are scarce. Taxpayers have limits. The math simply has to balance at the end of the fiscal year. Governments aren't venture capitalists, right? They act as fiduciaries and universal payers of last resort.
But being a fiduciary doesn't mean just cutting costs blindly.
No, it means ensuring value for money. That is why governments have a duty to utilize mechanisms like health technology assessments, HTA, and regulatory bodies like the Patented Medicine Prices Review Board, or PMPRB.
Okay, let's talk about why those exist.
Right. Let's talk about it. Because while innovation is crucial, we are dealing with an unregulated market characterized by highly inelastic demand.
Let's unpack inelastic demand for a moment for the listeners.
Right. So in a normal market, if the price of a car is too high, you don't buy it. You buy a cheaper car or you take the bus. The demand is elastic. It responds to price. But healthcare is fundamentally different.
Very different.
If you or a loved one are facing a terminal cancer diagnosis, you are entirely price insensitive. You don't shop around. You will pay absolutely anything. Mortgage your house, bankrupt your family, just to get that treatment.
True.
That dynamic represents a textbook potential market failure. A monopoly patent holder with a desperate patient population can theoretically charge an infinite price. That requires government intervention to protect the vulnerable.
But that intervention, that relentless bureaucratic drive for cost containment, often triggers a massive government failure that is far worse. Let's look at the true cost of cost containment. I want to introduce a different analogy from the text. Treating healthcare budgets like a balloon.
A balloon?
Yes. Think of the total healthcare system as a long inflated balloon. You have the drug budget in the middle and hospitals and physicians at either end.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
When policymakers squeeze the drug budget balloon in the middle to save money, the air doesn't just disappear, it rushes to the ends. It simply inflates costs elsewhere in the healthcare system. You squeeze out a $2 pill and the balloon bulges out as a $2,000 emergency room visit.
So you're talking about unintended consequences.
Exactly. Look at the mechanics of the 2003 British Columbia Therapeutic Substitution Policy. The government mandated that patients suffering from severe acid reflux disease switch from their prescribed proton pump inhibitor, or PPI, to the absolute cheapest brand PPI on the public formulary.
Okay.
They forced a medically unnecessary switch purely to save money. The government projected it would save $42 million in the drug budget.
Which is a significant saving for a fiduciary.
On paper, yes. But what actually happened? Because human biology is heterogeneous, the cheapest drug didn't work for everyone. Patients experienced adverse reactions. Some developed bleeding ulcers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And consider the transaction costs. Patients had to go back to their doctors to deal with the side effects, or they ended up in the emergency room. That single policy resulted in $43.51 million in additional hospital and physician costs. By trying to save a dollar on drugs, they spent more than a dollar on hospitals. The balloon just popped.
I come at it from a different way. A single poorly executed policy in British Columbia 2 decades ago does not invalidate the entire concept of cost containment. Let's talk about why formularies exist. The text acknowledges the existence of Me Too drugs.
Meaning drugs that are chemically very similar to ones already on the market.
Exactly. They enter an existing therapeutic class with only very marginal, sometimes microscopic improvements over what is already available. If a public health plan doesn't maintain a strict formulary and enforce some level of substitution, they would waste incredibly scarce public resources paying premium patent prices for minor chemical tweaks.
We have to draw a line somewhere on what constitutes true innovation worth premium price.
But the text explicitly deconstructs the myth of the Me Too drug as a negative force. You're looking at it purely as a waste of money. But having multiple drugs in the same therapeutic class creates inter-product competition.
How so?
As I mentioned with the BC example, patients are biologically heterogeneous. A slight chemical tweak that you call marginal might be the exact mechanism that saves a specific patient from severe, debilitating side effects.
But we are paying monopoly prices for each of those tweaks.
Actually, we aren't. And the economic data in the book proves it. This is where the invisible bidding war happens. When three similar drugs exist for a condition, public health plans can play the manufacturers against each other.
Right, the negotiations.
Yes. They say, we will only put your drug on our preferred formulary if you give us a massive confidential discount. That inter-product competition naturally lowers prices over a drug's lifetime. The data shows that this in-class competition costs the innovator just as much revenue as when a generic drug enters the market.
Interesting.
So by restricting the formulary and blocking Me Too drugs,
You're actually stifling the very market forces that naturally drive prices down.
Well, that assumes a functioning, highly elastic market, which we've already established is not the reality in healthcare. And we can't just look at past examples like acid reflux medications. We have to look at the sheer scale of the future. Right now, there is a growing pipeline of over 12,000 new medicines in various stages of clinical development. 12,000.
It's an incredible era of scientific discovery.
It is terrifying from a budgetary perspective. If a public health system is required to simply absorb every one of those 12,000 new drugs at whatever list price the manufacturer dictates, the system will bankrupt itself overnight.
I mean,
this is why centralized price negotiations are not just a good idea, they are vital for survival. Let's look at the Pan-Canadian Pharmaceutical Alliance, the PCPA.
The centralized buying group for the provinces.
Right. The PCPA acts as a monopsony. For our listeners, a monopsony is basically a market condition where there is only one buyer. Because the PCPA represents the entire Canadian public market, they have the ultimate leverage.
Mm-hmm.
If a pharmaceutical giant says no to their demanded price, that company loses out on millions of patients at once. It's the ultimate bulk discount. Using that leverage, they negotiate average rebates of 36% off list prices. That is a highly rational, effective use of buying power to protect the public purse from an overwhelming wave of new pipeline costs.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective on this whole narrative of the unsustainable drug budget. It is largely a myth driven by a misreading of the data.
A myth?
Yes. People see the Canadian Institute for Health Information, or CIHI, reporting $49.4 billion in total drug spending, and they panic. They think the ship is sinking right now. But when you isolate the PEMEX data, the patented medicines expenditure, the picture completely changes.
Wait, hold on. CIHI reports nearly $50 billion in drug spending. You can't just hand wave that massive number away. How are you isolating that data?
Because that $49.4 billion is a catch-all number. It includes generic drugs, pharmacy dispensing fees, retail markups, and even over-the-counter medications like pain relievers and allergy pills.
Okay.
Those have nothing to do with the cost of innovative new patents. If you look strictly at the PMX data, the direct cost of patented medicines paid by public plans, and then you apply that 36% PCPA rebate you just praised, you arrive at the real number. The net public spending on patented medicines in 2022 was only $5 billion.
Okay, but $5 billion is still a massive absolute number for any taxpayer to shoulder.
But context is everything in economics. That $5 billion represents a mere 2.1% of the $239.9 billion in total public health expenditure for that year. 2 cents on the dollar.
Well,
we have built this massive, hostile regulatory bureaucracy to suppress the prices of new drugs, and we are delaying or outright denying patients access to life-saving therapies, all over 2.1% of the budget. It is incredibly myopic to jeopardize our human capital over such a tiny slice of the pie.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that framing. Let me tell you why. That 2.1% figure is only that low because of the strict regulatory frameworks. It is low because of the health technology assessments and because of the massive leverage of those PCPA negotiations that are currently in place. You are pointing to the success of cost containment as a reason to dismantle it?
I'm pointing to it as evidence that the crisis is manufactured.
But if we repeal price controls, as the text suggests, and we just accept manufacturer list prices for those 12,000 pipeline drugs coming down the line, that 2.1% could rapidly expand to 10 or 15%. And because the total healthcare budget is finite, you can't just print money indefinitely. That expansion would directly threaten other vital areas of the healthcare safety net.
Right.
We're talking about funding for hospital beds, paying nurses, keeping emergency rooms open.
But again, this goes back to the balloon. You're assuming those innovative drugs just add cost, but they often reduce the need for those hospital beds and nurses. Curing hepatitis C with a pill means you don't have to pay for a $500,000 liver transplant down the road. And frankly, the way we determine what we are willing to pay for health is riddled with cognitive dissonance.
What do you mean by cognitive dissonance?
I mean the stark contradiction in how governments value human life depending on the context. Look at the data from the COVID-19 pandemic.
governments mandated lockdowns, borrowed billions of dollars, and intentionally reduced GDP to prevent viral spread.
Mm-hmm.
When economists divide the total fiscal support and economic loss by the number of life years saved, the implicit valuation of a life year during the pandemic was roughly $2.2 million.
It was an unprecedented global emergency.
Exactly. But look at how those same governments treat pharmaceutical innovation. When assessing a new patented medicine, health technology assessment agencies and the PMPRB use a highly restrictive pharmacoeconomic value threshold.
Let's explain what that threshold actually is.
Sure. They use a metric called a QALY, or quality adjusted life year. Essentially, the government decides that 1 year of perfect health is worth a maximum of $60,000. If a pharmaceutical company invents a cancer drug that costs $80,000 to give a patient one more good year of life, the agency rejects it. They say it's not cost effective.
$60,000 versus $2.2 million during COVID?
Yes, we will spend $2.2 million per life year to stop a virus. But we balk at paying more than $60,000 to give a cancer patient another year of quality life. This obsession with strict price controls is suffocating innovation. The regulatory delays just to get through this maze of assessments are causing massive patent term erosion.
Patent term erosion being the time a drug loses on its patent while waiting for approval.
Exactly. A patent lasts 20 years. But the data shows new drugs lose an average of 13.3 years of that 20-year term just waiting in the regulatory and formulary purgatory before they can actually be sold to the public.
That is a long time.
The commercial value of a patent in Canada is essentially reduced to a fraction of its intended lifespan. If you only have 6 or 7 years left to recoup a $4.5 billion investment, the math doesn't work. We are destroying the incentive to launch drugs here.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered the fundamental difference in the nature of the spending? You compared it to COVID. Acute crises like a pandemic threaten immediate catastrophic health system collapse. If the ICUs overflow, the entire society stops functioning.
Well, sure, but...
The fiscal response to that is necessarily massive, immediate, and most importantly, temporary. Pharmaceutical budgets, on the other hand, are long-term, chronic, recurring obligations. You cannot sustainably apply emergency crisis valuations to everyday perpetual expenses.
But the mechanism of evaluating the value of a human life shouldn't shift so wildly just because one threat is acute and the other is chronic. A life is a life.
But the mechanism of funding it has to reflect reality. We don't have infinite lumber for the ship. Furthermore, regarding price controls, defending international reference pricing is a highly valid fiduciary strategy.
You mean when a country looks at what other nations pay to set their own limits?
Exactly. A government looks at a basket of similar countries and says, we aren't going to pay more than the median of what France, Germany, and the UK are paying. It ensures that a country is paying its fair share for global R&D, rather than being subjected to pure price discrimination by a monopoly patent holder who is just trying to extract maximum profit from every distinct market.
I have to challenge that view of price discrimination, because the text makes a very strong economic case that price discrimination is actually a virtue in pharmaceutical markets.
A virtue? That's a massive claim. Charging different prices to different people for the exact same drug is a virtue?
Yes, because of how it funds the ecosystem. Empirical data from 31 OECD countries demonstrates a direct, positive correlation between higher market price levels and a higher number of new drug launches, as well as more industry-funded clinical trials.
Okay.
Price discrimination charging higher prices in wealthier countries or to private insurance plans is what actually funds the R&D. The higher prices in wealthier markets essentially subsidize the lower prices in lower-income markets. If every single country implements price controls and demands the lowest possible global price, if everyone insists on paying the absolute minimum fair share you're talking about, the capital required to fund that $4.5 billion R&D process disappears. The whole system collapses.
But that implies that countries with robust public safety nets should just willingly accept the highest prices to subsidize the rest of the world. As a fiduciary for domestic taxpayers, a health minister cannot ethically or legally say, we will overpay for this oncology drug so that a patient in another country gets it cheaper.
Right, but...
Their mandate, their legal responsibility, is to their own citizens and their own budget.
But by relentlessly suppressing prices, they are failing their own citizens. They are delaying access to new drugs. The 31 OECD country study shows this definitively. Lower prices mean fewer drug launches and delayed access.
Mm-hmm.
When you refuse to pay market prices, the innovator simply delays launching the product in your country or skips it entirely. You save money on paper, but your patients suffer. Your human capital degrades.
And if you pay whatever is asked, your patients might get the drug today, but the system might not be able to afford the nurses to administer it tomorrow. It is a profound structural risk that you can't just innovate your way out of.
Which brings us to the core summaries of our positions. When you stack all this up, the PMX data showing drugs are only 2.1% of the budget, the cost of patent erosion, the hidden hospital costs of the BC policy, the conclusion is clear to me. Restricting pharmaceutical incentives through heavy-handed price regulations is a textbook false economy.
A false economy.
Yes. It creates the illusion of savings while generating massive downstream costs. New medicines pay for themselves. They reduce hospitalizations, they shorten treatment times, they extend life, and they keep the workforce productive.
Right.
The data shows that provinces with more new drugs on their public formularies actually spend less on overall health care per capita. Pharmaceutical innovation is the ultimate investment in human capital, not merely a cost to be contained.
And yet, while the downstream benefits of innovation are undeniably powerful, the fiduciary duty to limit spending is what ensures the immediate survival of the healthcare safety net today.
Yeah.
You cannot fund tomorrow's miracles if today's system collapses under the weight of unchecked pricing power. In an inelastic market where desperate patients have no alternative, allowing unchecked pricing remains a structural risk that fiduciaries simply cannot ignore.
It is the ultimate tension. We are constantly caught between paying for the healthcare system of today and funding the medical breakthroughs of tomorrow.
The optimal balance between risking a market failure through unchecked pricing and causing a government failure through overregulation remains incredibly elusive.
Which is why we invite all of our listeners to dive deeper into the source material, Building Better Pharma Policy in Canada, and weigh this empirical data for yourselves. Think back to that leaking ship we talked about at the beginning. If we don't find a way to fairly fund the engineers building the pump of tomorrow, no amount of patching the hull today will keep us afloat forever.
But if we let the ship sink today, tomorrow never comes.
Something to think about. Until next time.